Welcome back to Passive Income Pilots, everyone. Tate Duryea and Ryan Gibson here. How you doing, Ryan?
Oh, I'm sorry. I was asleep. I'm sorry, bad joke.
good one.
Man, sorry, the dad jokes are coming out. Today, we're talking about sleep. If you're a pilot, if you're a person, sleep is probably one of the most important things about your overall health and wellness.
Absolutely.
Happiness, your mental acuity, all these things. And so what we did was we wanted to bring on a sleep specialist, someone who's a doctor who studies this, who's an aeromedical professional, and also has an ATP and is a pilot.
Exactly.
And somebody that can help you off the record get better at your sleeping or any health and wellness issues you have surrounding that before you go into your next medical. And if you've been a listener to this podcast, we've had tons of medical professionals on because we've got to protect the thing that helps us earn our income as airline pilots, right?
Absolutely.
You're not investing.
You got to protect the massive income so you can turn it into passive income.
Exactly. If you're not spending time, effort, energy into protecting your medical, you are going to lose this awesome job that you have flying airplanes, right? And so we want to help you prepare because our philosophy on the show is that your medical exam is like a check ride.
Right.
And if you're not preparing for that check ride on a regular and frequent basis and testing outside of that environment, then you could fail that check ride and then you create huge income earning potential problems. And so every once in a while on the show, we're going to bring on a medical professional. Today, we're going to focus on sleep. And even if you are not a pilot, you need to listen to this.
Absolutely.
Because we are going to he gives amazing advice surrounding how much sleep do you need? How do you prepare for bed? What do quick naps do for you? What kind of lighting should you have in your house and all this stuff, right? So tune in. Tate, who's the guest that we're bringing on today?
So we've got Dr. Adam Shapiro, MD, board certified sleep medicine specialist, a licensed pilot, and a member of the Coast Guard Auxiliary Aviation Division. He's a board certified sleep medicine doctor, also a head and neck surgeon, and founder of Aeromedical Sleep Consultants with a particular interest in human factors and sleep disorders. So board certified doctor for 30 plus years, pilot, understands everything under the sun in terms of sleep, circadian rhythm, sleep disorders like apnea, as well as insomnia. So great episode. Excited to jump into it.
Let's get into it.
Welcome to Passive Income Pilots, where pilots upgrade their money. This is the definitive source for personal finance and investment tactics for aviators. We interview world-renowned experts and share these lessons with the flying community. So if you're ready for practical knowledge and insights, let's roll.
Dr. Shapiro, thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure. Good to be here.
You know, we've been talking about having a sleep scientist on for years, and we finally got one. I can't wait to hear your background in your own words. Can you give the audience a little bit more about who you are and how you came to be?
Sure. Well, again, thanks for having me on the podcast. It's a pleasure and honor to be here. I am sort of riding a couple of different trains here. So I'm a sleep medicine specialist and an ear, nose, and throat specialist, head and neck surgeon. And I'm also an ATP rated pilot. So I sort of wanted to marry my two interests together. And I became interested in the aerospace sleep world. So I started flying 35 years ago. And I was a big bike rider and saw a advertisement for a $5 introductory flight lesson. This is obviously dating myself since it was quite a number of years ago, in Land O'Lakes, Wisconsin. And that $5 introductory lesson cost me a lot more later on, but it got me hooked in the aviation aerospace world. And I worked my way up through the ratings and actually through medical school. And I took some classes in meteorology just to sort of say I needed to brush up on some other areas there. And then in residency, where I didn't really have much time nor money, I got my private license and then went on to get some more of the ratings. And through that time, I've been involved with the Coast Guard Auxiliary. I've been an aircraft commander with them doing search and rescue missions and other patrols. And I've also gone and got a master's degree in at Embry-Riddle in aerospace science, and especially in human factors and space studies. So when I did my medical training, I probably had about 20 minutes of sleep education. It was really not considered of any import. We didn't really know that much about sleep. We thought that sleep was just important to get to the next day. And in residency, it was sort of a badge of honor to, you know, stay up for 3 days in a row. And you know, that there was no like thought about, you know, the need for sleep. And later on, we being in ear, nose, and throat and doing some surgeries for sleep problems, became really interested in sleep and wanted to pursue that. So I became interested in sleep medicine, got double boarded in sleep medicine, ran a couple of sleep centers, and found how important the dovetailing of sleep issues in the aerospace world is. So there are so many problems associated with sleep disorders and fatigue that are contributing to errors and accidents and mishaps and near mishaps that really need to get a handle on. In fact, in my master's program, I wrote a thesis on fatigue issues in aviation, and the vast majority of NTSB reports that I reviewed over a 20-year period had fatigue as a leading cause for the incident.
Dr. Shapiro, what do you do for pilots today? How do you help pilots, or how can they kind of engage with you and you know, sort of fix their issues with sleep?
Sure. Well, I'm also a senior aviation medical examiner. I've been that for about 30 years now. And I see people coming in for routine exams and people coming in for sleep issues that are pilots also. And then I'm also a consultant. I have a consulting business on the side for sleep and aviation problems for individual pilots, as well as organizations, you know, governmental, non-governmental organizations to help streamline their efficiencies. So, you know, we really have to tackle things on an individual basis. A lot of people have sleep issues. Most sleep problems are controllable. Most sleep problems are controllable to the point that you can keep your class one if you need that, or certainly two or three. And there may be a couple of hoops to jump through, but we can certainly help guide you through the process.
Well, I'm going to be selfish for a second and just say that I am the deepest sleeper that anybody has ever met. It doesn't matter if I drink a gallon of coffee an hour before I'm supposed to go to bed, I fall asleep. And, you know, a bomb could go off and I don't wake up. Unfortunately, my wife is not this way. She is woken up by anything and takes a long time to wind down and things like that. And I'll just say that, you know, I'll look at my phone up until the last second I go to bed and it doesn't matter. And she will, you know, she tries to do things that. So what would you say, you know, to somebody who's getting really bad sleep because they're a light sleeper? And, you know, because it seems like, I mean, I have all the bad habits, but I still get a good night's sleep. She seems to have good habits, but still gets a terrible night's sleep. And it really affects her, you know, during the day. I mean, she's just tired during the day, right? And it's, you know, and it leads to a lot of things. What would you say or do or work with somebody who's under kind of a light sleeper situation?
Well, it sounds like you spoke with my wife before we got on the call here, but it's a common problem. I hear it from her and I hear it from loads of patients and clients. So it's a common thing. Men, you know, generally are better sleepers than women as far as being able to fall asleep and stay asleep. Now, that doesn't mean that the quality of their sleep is better. In fact, men are more likely to have obstructive airway problems when they're sleeping than women. So they may think that they're sleeping well, but the actual quality of their sleep may not be as well as they think. But for your wife or any, you know, spouse or bed partner who is not sleeping as well because of other issues, really following a good sleep hygiene practices are a good idea. And that sleep hygiene means going to sleep at the same or close to the same time every night, even on the weekends, avoiding exposure to blue light products for at least 2 hours before you go to sleep. And that's phones, tablets, TV, all that kind of stuff. So if you say, well, I have to look at that stuff, you can get some blue light blocker glasses. Now, they're not blue glasses. They're just regular clear glasses that will block out the blue light. And that turns off the sleep-wake cycle from getting screwed up in the brain, thinking that the sunlight is beaming in on your eyes to say that it's daytime. Avoiding caffeine close to bedtime, and even avoiding caffeine anytime during the day. Now, I used to think that was, you know, heresy and is not possible. But if you don't drink any coffee during the day, you'll actually be more awake during the day than if you do, which is hard to fathom for many people, but it is the case. And even a cup of coffee in the morning or tea or chocolate can affect your sleeping late at night. And then avoiding eating too close to bedtime is also a good thing. And having a comfortable bedtime routine, a comfortable temperature when you sleep, have all kinds of bed options with chilly blankets and different kind of things, all kinds of things that can help with that kind of stuff.
I want to zoom out and ask, what is sleep and why do we need it?
That's an excellent question. You know, mammals and many other animals need sleep. What's happening when we're sleeping is we're repairing the damage done to the body during the day. It's like sort of parking yourself in the garage and having the maintenance crew work on you at night so that you can be tuned up during the day. And actually, the nerves endings in the brain are recharged and the damaged cells are repaired. So we really need it to stay alive. Done experiments on animals and unfortunately on people, kept people up, you know, for 2 weeks straight and they die. Okay. So we need sleep, like we need water, like we need air, like we need food. It's not a optional kind of thing. And if you don't get enough sleep or you don't get good quality sleep, you're developing a sleep debt. And that debt is to yourself and you have to repay it at some point.
I know a lot of pilots out there, you know, when you hear, you got to go to bed at the same time every night and have good sleep hygiene, that can be very difficult in this career.
Yes.
How does a pilot manage if they're flying a wide body aircraft across multiple time zones, maybe working 2 weeks out of the month? How does someone effectively manage that?
Well, there's a number of different strategies. One, I mean, the optimal strategy is to try to stay on the same time and not change your time. So if you are going from, you know, New York to London, you want to stay on New York time if that's where your home base is. That's sometimes difficult to do. Generally, if you move your clock an hour or two, it's not going to make that much of a difference. If you're moving it 4, 8, 12 hours, it is. So, you know, light strategy is the best strategy to use. And that is, you know, if you're going to be in a new time zone for a while, getting outside in the morning, getting exposed to sunlight, not staring at the sun and burning your eyes out, but just getting the ambient light from the sun will rejigger the biological clock, the circadian clock, tell us what time it is to go to sleep. And avoiding bright light exposure at night, which is the tablets and phones and things like that, are going to help with that too. So there's no real easy answer. It does take everybody 1 to 1.5 hours per day to reacclimate to a time zone. So right. A lot of times by the time you get someplace, it's time to come home and you have to redo it all over again. So in an ideal world, it's hard to do that, but you know, you want to try to stay on your same schedule as if that's possible.
I always fight with this age old question, which is, what's more important? I get to my layover, it's 11 hour layover. You know, it takes, you know, an hour to go to and fro, an hour to get myself ready. And maybe I've got to eat for a little bit. And inevitably, I'm staring down the barrel of getting 8 hours of sleep, which we all know is going to be 7 because it's going to take me a minute to fall asleep, or go exercise. What's more important, the exercise or the sleep?
The sleep. Okay. I mean, I'm all for exercise. I run marathons and bike 100 miles and stuff like that. So I'm all for it. But you need sleep. Okay. And, you know, if you can do, and you don't want to exercise too close to bedtime anyway. So, you know, if you want to do some push-ups and sit-ups when you wake up in the morning, better. better than doing that right before you go to sleep.
It's great advice.
And what's the cutoff? Is it, you know, at what point is it? Is it 8 hours of sleep, like minimum, or is it, you know, 6 hours? When are we weighing?
So the average, the average adult needs between 7 and 8.5 hours of sleep. That's not 7 or 8.5 hours of time in the bed, because as you said, it may take a little bit of time to fall asleep and you may wake up, you know, go to the bathroom, whatever. So you should be getting a minimum of 7 hours of sleep. If it gets to less than six, then you're really, you know, getting a sleep debt. Okay. Now people say, well, I'm going to get 6 hours. It's 11. I'm waking up at five. I'm getting 6 hours sleep. No, you're going to be in the bed. It's probably going to take you at least a few minutes to fall asleep. You may wake up a little bit in the middle of the night. You may not be aware that you're waking up, but if we were to monitor you at night, there'd be some times of wakefulness. And so that doesn't really count. So, you know, in the NTSB reports, which is something that we always have to think about, well, you know, if there is a mishap or an incident, the NTSB is going to investigate how much sleep you had the night before. And they're going to do that a number of ways. They're going to be looking at your phone, be looking at your watch or wearables. They're going to be looking at the door key to your hotel room to see what time you activated it. And if you look at your phone, even if you just pick it up to look at the time, they're going to know that you did that. And they're going to say, oh, he was awake at 2:23 looking at his phone. We know he didn't get as good a night's sleep. So you want them to not say that you were fatigued. So you want to make sure that you it's not you that was not as awake and alert as you could be. So you want to try to get, you know, forget the NTSB. You want to try to get 7 hours of sleep if you can at night. Now, generally, as we get older, that number goes down. And some of that goes down because we are more likely to have sleep problems. And those sleep problems can interfere with our sleep duration and the quality.
All right. Well, I want to talk about the gorilla in the room about red eyes. You know, red eyes are things, you know, we, you know, as pilots, we're people before we're pilots, right? And we have lives and things like that. And, you know, we might go in from a bunch of days off and do a red eye, or be an international pilot and be a red eye.
Yeah.
What are some of your best tips and tricks for preparing for maybe that first day of being on a red eye, knowing full well that we're pilots with children and lives, and we're going into our first, you know, 9 p.m. departure after having, you know, 4 or 5 days off of being on a normal body clock, right? A normal window, you know, circadian rhythm. And now we've got to stay up all night. You know, what are we doing that first day that's a best practice to really take care of ourselves in the best way we can?
Well, if it is possible, and from what you prefaced that with, it may not be possible, try to adjust your clock a little bit beforehand, even if it's a couple hours, sleeping a little bit later if you can, going to bed a little bit later if you can, sort of adjusting things to get on a different track, avoiding caffeine. Don't wake up at, you know, 6 a.m. that day and have 3 cups of coffee because you're going to crash, okay? You want to avoid the caffeine. If you need caffeine, use it strategically later in the night so that you can stay awake later in the night. So, and, you know, keeping yourself healthy, trying to eat well, don't have like a tremendously large meal right before you take off because that can have some sedative effects. And, you know, just try to get as much sleep as you can the nights before. If you get 8 hours of sleep the night before that, you're going to be able to tolerate that red eye night much better than if you've got 4 hours the night before. I mean, it's just, you're going to be, you know, owing a sleep debt, and you'll be able to manage that much better. And the other thing, you know, the real gorilla in the room is, do you have an underlying sleep problem? If you have an underlying sleep problem, that 8 hour night may be the equivalent of 4 hours of normal sleep. And you're really going to be fighting it and, you know, trying to, you know, stay awake that way. Now, you know, that being said, those sleep problems can be readily identified and readily fixed, and with much less paperwork than declaring an emergency, can go through the FAA and get a special issuance for whatever, you know, is going on. Not all sleep problems, but I would say the vast majority.
let's talk about sleep problems, right? Sleep disorders. And I don't know if we want to split this conversation into biological sleep disorders and mental sleep disorders, but I'd love to talk about what are the most common ones that you see and what is the cause? What is the remedy?
So the most common sleep problem that we see is obstructive sleep apnea. Obstructive sleep apnea is where the tissues, usually in the back of the throat and in the neck, collapse when we sleep. So when we go to sleep, all the muscles in our throat goes to sleep as well, and things will tend to flap back and forth like a flapper valve, and that's what causes snoring. But when you go to sleep, it will flap into the closed position and block the airway, and you actually have to wake up a little bit. Most times you're unaware that you're waking up, but just waking up enough to tighten up the airway so you can get a breath. And when that happens, depending on how long that happens for and how frequently that happens, that determines the severity of the sleep apnea. So if you have minimal sleep apnea, what we call upper airway resistance syndrome, where it's not quite closing, but it's closing a little bit, so you're straining and fighting to get a breath, that may not give you as much symptoms as full-blown sleep apnea, but you still can have terrible symptoms, be fatigued and tired with that. And the cure for it, there are many, many different cures, but the cause of this, going back to that, most times is weight. And it is the heaviness of our population, especially as we get older and especially as we're not eating as well as we could. If you're on a red eye, you're eating, more than you want to. That's what causes, it's a vicious cycle. The more you weigh, the worse you sleep. The worse you sleep, the more hungry you're going to be. So when you get a poor night's sleep, the brain secretes an appetite stimulant. And that stimulant says, eat, eat, eat. And when you get a good night's sleep, it secretes appetite suppressants. So without thinking about it, you're going to say, I'm not so hungry. So all of that plays a role in the sleep issues. So the other thing besides obstructive sleep apnea, we sometimes see central sleep apnea. Central sleep apnea is where the sleep center in the brain turns off the breathing inappropriately. Mm. So it tells you just, hey, take a break, don't breathe. And we stop breathing and our oxygen goes down and causes problems. And it's only when the fire alarms go off and, all kinds of problems happening that all of a sudden you'll take a breath. So that's a serious problem, but that can be readily treated minimally invasively as well.
Very interesting.
We see a lot of people with insomnia. Insomnia, there are very few people on the planet who have not had insomnia for one reason or another. If you have it for a day or two, that's just living in the world. If you have it for, 6 months, nonstop, you just can't sleep, that's a problem. That's chronic insomnia. And that, we need to find out what the cause of that is and treat it. And a lot of times you can treat insomnia relatively non-invasively, without medicine, without surgery. There's all kinds of tricks, therapies that can help with that kind of thing. And there's more unusual types of things. There's narcolepsy, there's hypersomnia, there's ADHD problems. A lot of those are amenable to medications that are acceptable to the FAA, as long as you get a special issuance, they know that you're on it. So, the FAA just wants you to, they don't want you to sweep things under the carpet. They want to know what's going on with you and they want you to fix yourself so you get better. Not so just so you get better, but because you'll be a safer pilot that way. So they're understanding if you have an issue with that. And in fact, on all aviation medical exams, your AME may not ask you, but they have to fill out part of the certification is a question that pertains to your sleep. This person is at risk of sleep apnea. This person has sleep apnea. This person has no risk of sleep apnea. This person needs to be evaluated for sleep apnea before I can give a certificate. So whether or not they're asking you these questions, they have to think about it and attest to that based on their exam. And most of them will be asking you, how's your sleeping? Are you getting enough rest? And are you having any problems? Are you snoring? That kind of stuff.
You're not the first aeromedical examiner that we've had on the show. In fact, you said that you personally know Dan Munlux, who we've had on before. And I love that the way Dan put it was, your flight physical is like your check ride. And if you've got issues, get those dealt with, go to an AME outside of the check ride and get these issues figured out. So what would you say to someone who might, know that they have some sleep issues, but have never disclosed it because they don't want to, get their medical pulled?
Right.
What actions should these pilots take if they'd like to get some help outside of the confines of going in for that check ride, so to speak, of a medical?
Right. I met Dan a couple times at meetings, a great guy. I don't know him that well, but I'd like to know him better. The issue with sleep, a lot of people, will tend to either shovel it under the carpet or they're unaware of it. 85% of adult men who have a sleep problem and 92% of adult women who have a sleep problem have absolutely no clue that they have a sleep problem. Hmm. And it usually will take either a bed partner or somebody like me to tap them on the shoulder and say, hey, I think, you need to look into this a little bit more. And it can be that they're coming in because they have a new diagnosis of diabetes or atrial fibrillation or uncontrolled hypertension, all of which are made worse by sleep problems. And we may see those and then say, I wonder why this is happening. Oh, look, they have gigantic tonsils and a real large tongue and a blockage in their nose. And, their soft palate is hanging down to their toes. And we can easily tell that they are obstructing, and you can, there are a number of different tests that you can do that are little screening tests. One is a stop bang test, and those stand for, different acronyms that we use for assessing whether somebody has a sleep issue. And some of it has to do with their neck circumference. So men who have a size 17 collar or bigger are more likely to have a sleep problem. People who have a BMI of over 30 are certainly more likely, and even people over 25 are more likely to have a sleep problem. And people who have hypertension, people who smoke, there's all kinds of things that will tip us off to that kind of stuff. But what I would tell the pilot is like, hey, we're going to hold your hand through this process. And I don't go about dinging people's medicals based on a concern or a suspicion of sleep apnea. Because if I didn't say, they're going to go fly and nothing's going to get done about it. So,
right.
I say, let's go do a check. And then what we can do, if there's any issue or question, is we say that we are in the process of evaluating and treating this person for a possible sleep issue. Okay. And, the FAA is like, great. Okay, that's terrific. Now, if we say this person fell asleep in my exam chair and I couldn't wake them up, that's another story, But if it's just, run-of-the-mill stuff, and I must tell you that I've been on a lot of flights and, with other pilots or, commercially me sitting as a passenger in the back, and I've seen the flight crew come out and I look at them and I can say, oh, boy, I hope this person stays awake because they can tell they have sleep apnea. I hope they brought their CPAP machine with them, or I hope they're being treated, otherwise. So, it is a big problem, and it is something that really needs to be addressed. And one of the major reasons for many of the mishaps, not just with pilots, but air traffic controllers, maintenance crew, ground personnel. Everybody is subject to having a sleep issue, and everybody's subject to having more errors and problems if they don't have their sleep issue under control.
Right.
I'd like to switch gears just a little bit. Does what you do during the day impact how many hours of sleep that you need? And let me give you a specific scenario. Years ago, I was involved in a regional airline pilot fatigue study where we measured the impacts of fatigue on how many legs you did versus how many hours you flew. So think of yourself as like a long haul pilot flying, one very long flight, and then a regional pilot maybe doing more up and down. Or now a lot of that regional flying has been sucked back up into the majors. So maybe a 737 pilot or a 717 pilot. Does your activity during the day impact your hours of sleep? I mean, earlier you said, I think it was like 7 to 8.5 hours is what you need.
Yes.
I have a fun way to approach this. I'd like to share my personal experience because I've done both. And Adam, you can tell me if medical science backs this up.
Okay.
All right. So when I was doing 8 legs a day, I was way more tired. I was a 717 captain, and I was way more tired at the end of the day than I was after flying a red eye, a 10-hour red eye on the wide body. But I bounced back faster. The next morning, I felt great. Whereas it took me, you know, a day and a half after flying that long haul red eye to feel normal again. Anyway, that's my personal experience. I'd love to hear if that's medically backed or if that's just my personal experience.
Well, a lot of things will play a role in that. I mean, if the long haul flight that you're doing is crossing multiple time zones, that's going to play much more of a role in your fatigue than just doing 8 flights a day. Okay. So, you know, your mental work that you're doing flying the 8 flights is much more than it is sitting there for 10 hours in one straight flight. So you're not as mentally stressed, emotionally stressed as you would be having to, you know, do 8 approaches in who knows what kind of weather. So as far as the sleep requirements, they're pretty close to the same each night. They do vary a bit based on your activity during the day, but most of that activity is aerobic activity that plays a role in that. So if you, you know, play 3 sets of tennis, you're going to probably need more recovery and sleep than if you are, you know, tuning in multiple ILS frequencies, you know, on the flight. So, but the brain does use up a lot of calories for doing a lot of work. And if you're, you know, playing 3-dimensional chess, you know, you're probably, you know, all day long, you're probably going to need a good night's sleep that night to, you know, get into the next game of chess in the morning. So what will play a role in general is your sleep debt. So if you don't sleep that well the night before or the night before that, you have to pay it back to yourself. And that's what's, and if you don't pay it back, then your fatigue level is going to go up. So it's sort of a counterbalance weight there.
You mentioned the calories that your brain burns. How true is that? You know, like people mention brain food and calorie burn and all that. Is that actually a thing? I'm just curious.
I think so. I don't think that, you know, you're going to make it, you know, you're going to become, you know, ultra, you know, class athlete just by sitting there doing calculus.
Math competition. Yeah.
I've always heard people like, oh, we're burning a lot of calories on this. And it's like, what are we doing to burn the calories? I guess my brain is just, you know, spinning. The processor is spinning too.
Maybe a little bit, you know. I think if you watch a scary movie and your heart rate goes up, you'll probably burn more calories.
Yeah, there you go.
That way. You know, it's really, it has to do with cardiovascular. How fast is your heart beating? What are the changes in heart rate variability? How is your blood pressure being altered? Your respiratory rate? I mean, there's a lot of stuff that plays a role in that. Is your, you know, oxygen carrying capacity, you know, changing throughout the day, you know, being subject to cabin altitude pressure. If you live at sea level and you are spending the day at 8,000 feet, that's going to make you tired. You know, and
yeah,
you know, that's right. That's going to fatigue you. So, and the number of hours, you know, that, and if you have a sleep disorder that causes oxygen desaturations, and you are living, or you're a smoker, or your baseline oxygen level is low, and then you're exposed to high altitude stuff, and you are not, you know, a native of Colorado, you're going to be more fatigued than somebody who is, you know, pressurized at sea level. They're just, you know, or wearing oxygen or something like that.
You mentioned oxygen carrying capacity. You know, I recently heard that your VO2 max is the most accurate indicator of your longevity. Let's talk about longevity.
Peter Attia, 60 Minutes.
Yeah.
You watched it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's right. So what is VO2 max for anybody that doesn't know? And then let's talk about staying healthy, because I think, you know, in aviation, there's a lot of suck it up mindset, which is, you know, I tend to kind of fall on that side of the spectrum. It's like, you know, toughen up, suck it up, do what you got to do. I kind of have that old school mentality. But we were talking before the show about how lack of sleep or chronic fatigue can cause all sorts of real biological issues like hypertension and diabetes. So how do we live as healthily as possible for the longest lifespan possible?
Good questions. I think
I threw a lot at you there.
So. Yeah. I mean, I think we all, you know, as we all get a little older, we're all looking at the, you know, the light at the end of the tunnel there, and we want to, you know, keep that light a little bit farther away from us as long as we can.
Right.
So I have no reason to disagree with Peter Attia about that. It sounds like the VO2 max probably is one of the more important markers. You know, the red blood cells in our body carry the oxygen, and it depends on how many red blood cells you have, the size of the red blood cells, the permeability of the red blood cells, and how these interact with the lung tissue when these red blood cells deposit the oxygen into the bloodstream and when they get recharged with oxygen. And your body's ability to deal with that will naturally decrease with time as we get older, but you can change that. You can exercise, get in good shape, sleep well, avoid medications and drugs that are going to adversely affect that. You know, keep your sugars intact, keep your electrolytes in check. There's a lot of different things. It's not just one thing. It's nice to just say, well, here's, you know, here's the level on the fuel gauge. My level is good, so I don't have to worry about anything else. There's a lot of things that go into that. So I think you can't really just look at one thing. And it would be nice to just characterize everybody as being the same. We are very similar, but everybody's a little bit different, and everybody has a little bit different issue. And their issues need really to be tailored for themselves. But certainly getting your VO2 max up as high as you can, it's a great idea. And really by sleeping well and exercising, eating well, that's the way to do it.
Absolutely.
I want to jump back to sleep stuff real quick. So years ago, the FAA ruled that in-flight napping was not approved. And it's been kind of this topic for years of, you know, I think Europe, the EASA or other aviation.
Canada as well. Controlled rest.
Yeah, controlled rest, you know, during flights. And, you know, I'm not going to sit here and admit anything, but I've heard of, you know, studying the overhead panel and getting in a wink or two, you know, during a time when you are feeling fatigued on a flight has benefited the pilot, you know, later on in a more critical phase. And so what are your opinions on this? And I know you're not here to say what to do or not to do or advise a pilot, you know, what is legal and not legal. What's your opinion on this overall? You know, does the FAA have this wrong? Should they be considering controlled sleeping in the flight deck? You know, what's your overall thoughts?
Well, when I was flying my Citation at 430, single pilot, I chose not to nap while I was up there.
Fair.
Yeah.
Thank you.
That's fair. I think that the most important thing for safety reasons is to make sure, if that is going to happen, to make sure that the pilot flying is wide awake and not thinking about dozing off also. And that there is a clear, I mean, I know this is not accepted now, but if it is going to happen and it's not the rules and it's not something that you should do, but if it is going to happen, you need to have a clear understanding with each other, you know, okay, you're going to fly for a bit, I'm going to just take a nap for, you know, a few minutes. So, you know, power naps, as they say, for, you know, 15, 20 minutes can be very helpful and to recharge things and to get a lot of, you know, your alertness and concentration back. But it has to be done at a time, not a critical phase of flight, obviously, not if there's a, you know, some other issues going on, and not without the other person fully aware and accepting of that. But I think that's a lot of times you'll say, well, you know, I'm really tired, I'm going to take a nap, and you don't get the, you know, okay, or, you know, well, I'd prefer that you don't, you know, I mean, you have to have a, you know, a, it's sort of like handing off control, like, you know, who's pilot flying, who's not. You need to, you know, understand that, have an understanding of that. But from a scientific point of view, I think it is a good idea to be able to, you know, have a power nap, you know, if that's possible.
Personally, I think it's kind of silly that it's not allowed. I mean, I can go take a biological break. I can leave the cockpit for, you know, a limited amount of time to go to the bathroom, to go freshen up in the galley, get a cup of coffee, whatever it is. I mean, what's, you know, to me, I mean, I'm again, we're not, be clear, like, this podcast isn't advising people to do what Dr. Shapiro just suggested. But I was just trying to get the heart at the, you know, the philosophy behind that. I mean, a 15-minute nap, I mean, what does that really do for you? I mean, I know.
Yeah, I was going to say, do you have any data points on what a 15-minute, you know, not even a deep sleep, just a dozing off for 15 minutes?
There have been a number of studies to show that that does improve concentration for, you know, the following hour or two after that. But there are also studies to show that if you sleep longer than that, you will develop some sleep inertia.
Right.
And sleep inertia means that you are going to be more tired. So you got to find that real happy medium, and it is not for everybody. So I think that the reason, and it's not incorrect reasoning, that the FAA has said that we don't want that happening is a couple of reasons. One, there have been some incidents that have been very public that, you know, two pilots have overflown and missed the destination and, you know, had to call and say, oops. You know, they don't want to hear that kind of thing. That's not something that they want to condone. And the other is, where is the individual pilot's sleep inertia going to take effect? So, you know, is it going to be at 30 minutes? Is it going to be at 60, at 90? And where do you draw the line? Okay, is there a timer that you have to set? Okay, we're going to give you 20 minutes. You know, I mean, they have the rules where, you know, the ultra long flights have shift changes, you know, and that's where you go take a nap. That's whether it's condoned to do that. So I think that, you know, until, and you know, the FAA moves at a glacial pace to make changes, and it's not necessarily wrong because they want to gather all the data, you know, for that kind of stuff. But if you blanketly say, you know, all right, everybody, you can take a nap without specifying, okay, the nap will be no longer than 18 minutes, and it can't be unless you're at cruise altitude, and you can't be, you know, less than an hour to your destination. I mean, so you have to have a whole bunch of stuff, and the other person, you know, has to do a cognitive test to make sure they're wide awake. I mean, whatever it is.
Right.
So I don't see that happening too soon. I think part of it is that the public, who, you know, is maybe not happy about hearing about that. And, you know, they talk about having single pilot flight crews. If you say, well, we're having one guy napping and we have one pilot flying, why do we need that second pilot? So I think that there may be reasons that are deeper why people are not pushing to have that. There may be some.
Yeah, that all makes a lot of sense. I know, it, you know, speaking of things in the news, I know it's legal in Canada, and they have the cabin crew call up after 20 minutes just to make sure that both pilots hadn't fallen asleep, right? And there was, did you guys see this news article where a pilot was taking a nap, woke up from the controlled rest, saw some stars out there and thought it was traffic, clicked the autopilot off and put the airplane into a dive. So like,
oh, wow.
You know, this is why we can't have nice things.
And so because of that risk of sleep inertia really is you can't, you're more groggy, you're in a semi-dreamlike state when you wake up. You know, there's some people who may have that when they wake up and see those stars. So probably, you know, the pilot flying should make sure that the new napper, you know, who has just woken up is quite awake before they hand over the realm.
Regain control.
The reins, exactly.
Exactly.
All right, I want to settle the debate. Nighttime flight, not personal preference. I want the scientific answer to this. Dome lights on or dome lights off going on a night flight across the country? Are we leaving the lights on in the flight deck, or are we turning them off? Because a lot of, you know, Tate, you're like,
that's a good one.
Tate, are you a lights on guy or a lights off guy?
It depends.
Depends.
It depends. You know, some if I'm tired, I'd say lights on. If I'm not, you know, it's nice kind of having the lights off and looking at the stars.
I think a lot of it depends on the color spectrum of the light also.
That's an interesting one. I wonder if Airbus has ever talked about, you know, the spectrum of lights that they put in the cockpit.
Yeah, they are. I believe that they are making changes with that kind of stuff. And
interesting.
Just like the, you know, even in the cabin, they're changing the spectrum of lights to different times of the day. I think they are doing that to help with circadian changes that way. So. And that's probably going to be more common to help keep you awake that way.
Yeah, it's like a what you mean is like a daylight
blue spectrum
LED versus like a soft white you know, okay, gotcha.
Yeah, having more of the blue light spectrum that emulates the ultraviolet the sun will stimulate the cells in the eyes to think that it's daytime. Years ago, we used to think that there were just rods and cones in the eye, which, you know, the color vision and the black and white vision that we would see. But we now know that there are other receptors in the eyes that we can't see, but they're only for receiving light that goes directly to the sleep-wake cycle in the brain. And that is essential for us to stay awake. So people who are blind have terrible problems with their sleep-wake cycle. They can't, they're up and sleeping. They can't keep a 24-hour schedule. They need to be medicated, actually, to be able to go to sleep and wake up at normal times. So
that's so interesting.
Yeah, it is. It is fascinating that way.
Well, I want to conclude with one more question, which is, I always hear this, for those that have children, I've heard that younger people and older people need different amounts of sleep, and that it's different importance of how long it is. Is there any truth to that, or what is the truth to that old adage?
There's a lot of truth to that. So little kids, I mean, infants need 20 hours of sleep. You know, neonates, you know, they're sleeping all the time. I think 10-year-olds, you know, need 11 hours of sleep, and it goes down from there. And because of the, you know, but since the advent of electricity and the light bulb, humans have gotten less and less and less sleep. We are, you know, up watching, you know, the late show, and we're, you know, up in the morning, you know, with the lights on before the sun comes up. So we've got a million different things to do and a lot of excuses not to sleep. So we can think of all kinds of things. Oh, I got to call my friend. I got to do all this kind of stuff. Whereas in the old days, it used to be the sun would go down. There's nothing else to do. You go to sleep and you wake up when the sun comes up. So we did get a lot more sleep, you know, back, you know, hundreds of years ago. So that being said, once you're an adult meaning 21 plus, there are very few people that need less than 7 hours of sleep. There's 1% of the population that are called short sleepers, and they can get by with 4 hours of sleep. And those are usually pretty extraordinary people. They can speak 12 languages and, you know, play 12 musical instruments and things like that. So, the vast majority of most people, and you will know if you get 4 hours of sleep every night, you're not going to feel well rested for most of us. You know, we need the 7+ hours of sleep.
I'm jealous. I wish I was one of those people. I'm an eight hour guy.
Totally. Yeah. Same here.
Dr. Shapiro, thank you so much for joining us. This has been highly enlightening. Any parting words before we can tell people how they can get in touch with you and follow you?
Well, listen to yourself. If you feel tired, you know, get yourself checked. Go to your doc and, you know, first try to sleep more. And then if you're still tired, if you're sleeping more, go to your doctor and find out what's going on. And, you know, I would hate to say it, but most doctors are not as tuned into sleep as we should be, just because we didn't get that much training in sleep.
Right.
So if you have concern, go to a sleep doc. There's sleep doctors everywhere, you know, and we're happy to, you know, look into things. It doesn't mean you're going to get grounded or anything like that. And you could be a much more happy, healthy, vibrant person. And you're probably going to keep your medical longer because you're going to prevent yourself from having a stroke or a heart attack or high blood pressure that's uncontrolled and diabetes. So, you know, we'll keep you, you know, riding in the cockpit longer and also keep you riding through life longer and happier and healthier.
Wonderful. If people want to connect directly with you, how can they do so? How can they follow you? I know you're based in Florida. If somebody actually wants to come see you.
Yeah, well, you don't have to come far. We're happy to, we do consultations remotely. You can go to our website, which is aeromedsleep.com, aeromedsleep.com, and drop us a note, and we have a whole team, and we're happy to help you with your problem if it's an individual, or we take care of some organizations as well to try to streamline their processes and make sure everybody's happy and healthy there too.
We love it.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for the wisdom. Really appreciate you coming on. We look forward to another conversation sometime in the future.
Thank you so much for having me. And it's been a pleasure, and really enjoy your podcast. So look forward to hearing more of them.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.